You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 139 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the 2018 NFL playoff appearing Seattle Seahawks. Or is it the 2019 NFL playoffs? I don't know.
It's the 2019 NFL playoffs.
Because it's the 2018 season. It's always confusing. We are here to talk about that. Not whether it's 2018 or 2019.
full breakdown.
We have so much to get to.
I want to get through all of this other stuff so fast. I want to get to football. I am ready. I'm sitting here doing research. I am so ready to talk football. But first, we need to toast.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's not get through this quickly. Because we have some interesting beer here.
This was purchased by me in Portland, Oregon at Deschutes Brewery. We have Deschutes.
I don't know if that translates audibly. It's D-A-S-H-O-O-T-Z. Deschutes.
Des Cahooties? Deschutes? Des Schwetzes? We've heard it all over our 30 years of craft brewing, which is why we're making it easy this time around. Simple in design, yet obsessively created within the obstacle course of our Bend Brewery. We offer this beer design to pair with doing. Leave the over... Including doing podcasts.
Are we really doing here?
Leave the overthinking to us. It's the only way we know how to brew beer. Well, we'll let you do the podcast, Deschutes. We're the only ones who overthink here.
Yeah.
About Washington Husky play calling in the Rose Bowl.
Some of that might have been underthought as it turned out.
But a toast is in order to me.
Oh, I hate it when a toast is in order to you.
As predicted by me on this podcast, I put you out of your misery in fantasy football, soundly defeating you. Do you know that
First off, you didn't put me out of my misery because of the fact that all the way through the Sunday night's game, which I was not watching because it was not an NFL game, or an NBA game rather, but was following along on the game tracker, still hoping for that 80-yard T.Y. Hilton touchdown to get me right back into the mix.
I beat you in fantasy football. Both weeks I beat you over our two-week playoff that goes into week 17. And, as I also predicted on Twitter, it was because of C.J. Anderson.
It really was because of C.J. Anderson. I mean, it was also partially because Devontae Adams didn't play at the last minute, and my replacement for him, Robbie Anderson of the Jets, scored like a 2. That wasn't the best.
I'm going to get an MVP chant going for C.J. Anderson.
So, you the real MVP.
Best running back in the NFL, fantasy football MVP, C.J. Anderson. Not Robbie Anderson. The other Anderson.
You the real MVP.
That pours nice into these Pelton Cast mugs.
Sure does.
Next week, I didn't have time to do... I'm doing a lot of research here to find the sourest beer possible. Just sour beer isn't going to be enough. It has to be sourer beer for you to drink on this very podcast.
We're not going to talk about my trip to LA this week because of the fact that we have a subsequent trip to LA coming. We're just going to fold that all together in talking about LA food. But I did want to note on New Year's Eve with Third Pelton brother Nate Taggart, loyal listeners, the Millers, Tyler, the whole crew. It was a great time, but we went to the Mickler Brewer or the brew pub in
Mickler.
Yes. Okay. I don't know if that's actually how it's pronounced. Beer bar in downtown LA.
Deschutes.
And there was a lot of sour beers on the menu.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There we go. Did any of that group drink any?
Yeah, I think so.
There we go.
There were some saisons. Like to see.
Oh, saisons aren't sour. Are you kidding me?
No, there were some legitimately sour beers in there as well. I stayed as far away as I could. It was a Three Floyds takeover.
Oh, Three Floyds takeover.
Yeah, we were in a hurry. I didn't get a chance to snap a picture, but...
That's pretty fun.
Tyler had a beer that was 15% alcohol by volume and tasted like pure chocolate.
Really?
It was the most fascinating thing I'd ever seen.
This was my 7th fantasy football championship in the last decade in this league.
Still looking for number one.
You're still looking for number one because a lot of times people come to me and they say, is the competition really that good? Are you actually that dominant? And I say to the person who says this to me, you're in the league too.
Oh, no.
And you have won in that time period as many championships as the University of Oregon has won.
Oh, boy. But I've made more finals appearances. They've only made it twice to the championship. But...
Oh, than the University of Oregon.
Yeah. But I'm 0-3 in the
finals. You're 0-3 in the finals?
Not a big fan of those week 16, week 17 finals that I always lose.
Was it 2-me and 1 to Cousin Katie?
No. This was the first time I lost
the finals. Yeah. Who else did you lose to? Chris?
I believe Jason last year.
Oh, that was last year?
It was. Whew, 2 years in a row I've made it. I'm back-to-back finals
appearances. Sweating that one out. This was, in that league, my greatest fantasy football season ever. I was... 12-2 in the regular season. Does that math add up?
It does not. We played 13 weeks.
Okay, I was 11-2 in the regular season, and I won every single week of the playoffs.
Well, aren't you in Patrick?
15-2 fantasy football year.
Aren't you in Patrick Mahomes special? And CJ Anderson.
And CJ Anderson. Thank you to Pat Mahomes. And to CJ Anderson, of course, for winning me this fantasy football championship and making you have to drink the sourest possible beer I can find.
I'm making bitter beer face just thinking about this possibility.
I'm so excited.
Which doesn't translate well in the podcast. Do you want to jump in and talk about the Seahawks now? Or do you want to get through
this? Get through all this other crap fast.
All right, well, let's start with the unexpected return of an old friend.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
So I'm sure you saw that the Mariners signed left-handed pitcher Yusei Kikuchi to a contract this week. And that got me thinking, with the Mariners rebuild, with their teardown, they should seek out a more appropriate level of competition. A place where the Mariners are beloved, which is not Seattle. That place is Japan. The Mariners should go play in the NPB. NBP over the next 2 years while they're rebuilding the roster and seek out their own level. Water seeks out its own level. The Mariners should seek out their own level because let me tell you, the American League sure as hell isn't going to be it for the next few years. Now, I grant it would get a little confusing with the Chivalote Marines who are already in the Pacific League in NBP. We'd have to put the Mariners, I think, in the other league, which is good because the other league has the DH. That's more appropriate for them, even if they don't have Nelson Cruz anymore. They're going to want to be in the American League equivalent. I give them a pretty decent chance of winning. I think, you know, Kikuchi was one of the best pitchers in Japan. The runner-up for the Sawamura Award for the top pitcher in whichever of those two leagues he's in 2017 when he finished with a 1.97 ERA. You take him, you bring in, I think, Marco Gonzalez would be great in Japanese baseball. The Mariners hitting Kyle Seager, that might be a chance for him to bounce back against Japanese pitching. I think this is the right move for the Mariners. And here's the best part. He would free up Safeco Field. I'm sorry, T-Mobile Park. To host and chant year-round from now on.
Chant year-round.
It's the most popular thing that's happened in that stadium in a long time.
Hopefully the shift hasn't come to Japan yet for Kyle Seager's sake. Hopefully that one hasn't made it across the ocean. I like this idea, though.
I don't know. We need to come up with a hashtag.
Yeah, we should work on that.
We'll workshop that over the course of this podcast.
I think the Mariners, at the very least, even if they wouldn't win the Japanese World Series, whatever that may be called, I could see them at least making the playoffs.
Snapping that 18-year
drought.
They
can break the streak.
I like it. Yeah, I mean, I think who would be opposed to this? Who would be opposed to this? It's the Japan Series. It's
the Japan Series?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is interesting. Kikuchi's contract is first reported by John Heyman. It's a base contract of 3 years, $43 million. And then after the 2021 season, the third year of that deal, the Mariners will have a team option that, if exercised, would add 4 years and $66 million to the contract. So it could be a seven-year contract. But then if the team declines the option, Kikuchi will have a $13 million player option for 2022. So if he wants, he's guaranteed $56 million on this contract. He's age 27, so, you know, he'll be tail end of his prime at that point. It seems unlikely the Mariners would want to pick up that four-year option, taking him through all the way through age 34, but I guess we'll see.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
What was Yusei Kikuchi thinking when he signed this contract?
Oh, did you see on Twitter what he was thinking?
I did see what he was thinking.
They were the team that needed me the most.
But, like, did he look at Felix Hernandez's career of never pitching in the playoffs and say to himself, that's for me?
not everyone is their number one priority is getting to the playoffs. Or maybe he just thinks he's so good that he's going to get them over the top, whereas Felix couldn't.
Maybe.
Can't rule it out.
Why didn't Shohei Ohtani think that the Mariners were the team that needed him the most? Also, what would the situation have been like? Let's say that we have a time machine and we just put Shohei Ohtani on the Mariners last season. He probably wasn't good enough to push them over the top to the playoffs.
I think he might have been.
Do they still tear it down if they have Ohtani?
They might not.
Because it would be a real shame if you have Shohei Ohtani and he comes over and signs like a long-term deal and then all of a sudden you trade every single player on the team.
Yeah. He really lucked out.
He really did. Sadly for Yusei Kikuchi, he may have to be in Seattle for like 9 years.
7 tops.
At least by the time it's over, he'll be able to take light rail to the Queen Anne area.
New arena at Seattle Center. Good times. Also making a roster move during their offseason, the Sounders made a trade to acquire center back Jonathan Campbell from the Chicago Fire for a 2020 fourth round pick. Campbell, who was the Fire's first round pick back in 2016, has made 49 starts over the last 3 seasons, but just 15 appearances last year as he kind of fell out of favor. He had some depth to an aging back line. There's been a lot of rumors that Roman Torres might move on this offseason after he was edged out for a starting spot last year by Kim Keehee, along with Chad Marshall. You know, we've mentioned the age of those players, so the Sounders definitely needed to inject some youth there. And Campbell, excited to be back. He played for the Sounders U23 team while in college before being drafted by the Fire.
They sure added a younger body to the team.
Yes, they did. That's the most... at the very lowest price possible.
2020. How many rounds are there?
4.
Okay. I was going to say, I did not know that there were 4 rounds in that. What is it called? The MLS Super Draft?
Yes.
Really? That's what they call it?
It is.
There we go.
Yeah.
On fire.
UW men's basketball. We took last week off from discussing the basketball programs at UW, and UW took the first half off on New Year's Day.
Seems like they do that a lot.
They do that a lot, trailing at the half to Cal State Fullerton.
Oh, you were talking about the basketball team took the first half off.
Oh, yeah.
I get it. Okay.
I mean, yes. Applies to either of them. Before coming from behind for an 84-76 win to finish non-conference play at 9-4, they will open up Pac-12 play this Saturday. And another classic case of scheduling working out well. Not that necessarily you could have predicted when the Seahawks playoff game was going to be, but right during the second half of that Seahawks playoff game, the Huskies will tip off against the Cougars.
Were you watching the game against Cal State Fullerton?
Did
you see any of it?
No.
It might have been the least amount of people who have ever been in that stadium for a basketball game.
Really?
You're talking about coming off.
Because I had a friend who texted me and said that it was a surprisingly good crowd.
Really?
Yeah.
Was he expecting nobody to be there? Italian soccer style?
Was she expecting no one to be there?
Wow. She was expecting it to be like an Italian soccer game where they weren't allowed to have fans.
Perhaps that was the case. I don't know. I was only going by her intuition. So that was your takeaway from the game?
I mean, they didn't show any wide shots, but it seemed like there were plenty of good seats still available for that one.
I'm sure there were, and probably still will be, unfortunately, for Saturday's game. But maybe people. I mean, I once went to a Husky game opposite the Beastquake, so that was a bit more exciting time.
I went to a Husky game opposite the last time that the Seahawks played the Dallas Cowboys in the playoffs.
Really?
Do you remember this?
I remember you not being there, but I didn't know it was for Husky basketball.
You were watching at Chris's house, right?
I was.
Mrs. Fantasy Genius was there. Everybody was there having a good time. Yet me and the famous cousin Katie were watching UW versus USC.
The common denominator here, the famous cousin Katie, is stuck watching Husky basketball during many great Seahawks playoff moments.
Was she at the Beastquake game too?
She was, yes.
The crazy thing is, in what year was that, 2006?
Probably the 2006 regular season, 2007.
In 2007, going to a Husky basketball regular season game seemed like a better priority than watching a Seahawk playoff game. That is how different this program is now. Like, the idea of this is home against Wazoo?
Yes.
You're definitely not going to that, are you?
I am not, no.
The idea that you would go to this Husky basketball game now and miss the Seahawks playoff game is unheard of.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So, the let's just say the two programs are in a very different
place. I mean, I wasn't going anyway because there was a Blazers game on Saturday night. I was going to go to that.
So you're missing that.
Yes. WSU has gone 7-6 in non-conference play against a schedule ranked 346th in the nation by KenPom.com. Just one of those wins against Rider has come over a team ranked higher than 288th in the KenPom rankings. They lost at Seattle U in Kent to Montana State in their annual Tri-Cities game, 2 of 3 in the Diamond Head Classic, and most recently to Santa Clara in Spokane last week without star forward Robert Franks.
They're playing in Spokane, they're playing in Kent, they're playing in the Tri-Cities.
Well, the Kent game was a road game. That was a Seattle U home game, but...
Oh, and that's where Seattle U plays now, is at the Showair Center?
Just when they have big games.
They're playing at Kent Lake High School or something?
It was, in fact, at the Showair Center. They annually play a game in the Tri-Cities, or a game or two. Usually it's during winter break, though, because like when the students are off campus, doesn't make that much sense for them to play in Pullman. So that's why the other game was in Spokane. Like, now their fans are more likely to be in Spokane during winter break than in Pullman.
Where do you play in the Tri-Cities?
Wherever it is that the
Tri-City
the
Dust Devils play.
No.
Tri-City Americans.
The Tri-City Americans, yes.
They used to be the Dust Devils, right?
The baseball team used to be the Dust Devils.
Isn't the Americans a baseball team also?
No, I think the Americans are the hockey team.
Oh, yeah, that's the hockey team. So they play wherever they play. I thought he played for the Tri-Cities Americans. He played for the Dust Devils?
Either that or the Posse. It's one of Dust Devils and Posse are the two names.
I don't think he played for
If
the
only
Posse.
We could look up this information. If only there were... So Robert Franks is expected back to play against UW this Saturday, according to Ernie Kent. That's big news for them. He has been excellent this season. He's played his way on in the NBA radar. He's shooting 65% on twos, has a great assist rate for a big man. The Cougars have actually been pretty good offensively. They're 30th in the nation in effective field goal percentage, granted against this week's schedule, shooting 56% on twos, but they rank 273rd in adjusted defensive efficiency. So all of this is to say that, of course, they are going to come into Hackett and beat the Huskies. If I know anything about
they're
how this game is played.
They're not
going to
beat the Huskies, but they're going to be up at the half.
Well, they're definitely going to be up at the half, yes.
They're going to be up 8 at the half, and the Huskies will be tied within the first 5 minutes of the second half and then win comfortably. I've seen this game over and over and over again this
year. Yeah, but 2 years ago, this game was played the exact same weekend. It was exciting because I think it did manage to miss that year when they played the Lions at home. I can't remember. I think maybe they played on Sunday that weekend.
I just had a baby.
That it's accurate.
I do not remember this Wazoo game.
And the Husky and Wazoo had been terrible in non-conference, as Wazoo is wont to do under whoever is coaching them since the Bennetts. And then the Huskies lost with Markel Fultz. Hmm. Yeah.
They're not going to lose this game. Relax.
We said it was going to be different against Arizona. I guess it was. They did eventually win. It was the Tri-City Dust Devils when Russell Wilson played for them. So there you go. Elsewhere in the Pac-12, it's been a great week for the Pac-12. UCLA fired coach Steve Alford after losing at home to Liberty to drop to 7-6 in non-conference play.
His child is not on the team anymore, is he?
No, he does not have any children on the team. Assistant Murray Bartow will coach the rest of the season on an interim basis. And one name being mentioned as a possible replacement. One name has appeared on the Pelton cast as a third Pelton brother. That, of course, being UCLA alum and former Sonic Earl Watson.
There we go.
In the mix for that job.
What is Earl Watson doing right now?
He's been doing some TV work and was finishing his degree after he was let go by the Suns last season. Hmm. So he's there in LA ready to take over. Also, Oregon's Bull Bull has been ruled out for the season due to a non-displaced navicular fracture in his left foot. So another hit to a team that was expected to contend in the Pac-12. And let me tell you, Arizona State lost at home tonight in their season, Pac-12 opener. Hashtag one bid Pac-12.
It's gaining steam. Pac-12. Oh, God. I'm still holding out hope for the two bid Pac-12.
That'd be ideal.
I'm a blind optimist.
You're always 5% more optimistic. UW women's basketball started Pac-12 play.
The one way that they could combat this is by finding some sort of celebrity to make jokes about how late the games are. They need to make a lot. They need to find some influencers on Instagram to start talking a little bit more about Pac-12 basketball. That's how they're going to fix it.
I mean, first off, we know some influencers right here who are talking about Pac-12 basketball. Maybe not on Instagram.
You want 230 followers? Hashtag Pac-12. Give us a call, Larry.
Yeah,
you see this thing that I'm referencing?
Yes, I did. Okay. See that. Yes.
Oh, it was my favorite thing.
I have some thoughts, but we don't have enough time to get into Larry Scott on the podcast today. We do not have enough time for that. Because we got to talk about UW women's basketball. It started Pac-12 play last weekend, losing at home to Washington State, 79-76. And that was bad news for the UW women coming off their solid non-conference, because the road gets much more difficult this weekend when they will play Friday at number 5 Oregon, fresh off their upset victory over Mississippi State, who then came into UW and beat the Huskies by about 50 points, 55 or so, I think, in that game. Oregon, a serious Final Four contender this year with the nation's best player, Sabrina Ionescu. And then Sunday, it's at number 11, Oregon State. So the Oregon trip, not a fun one for opposing Pac-12 women's basketball teams this year. So probably going to be a rough go of it for the UW women this weekend. All right, do we want to talk Seahawks now?
Yeah, let's talk Seahawks.
All right, the Seahawks.
Yeah.
We'll wrap up with the Rose Bowl. Seahawks headed to Dallas to play this Saturday after securing the number 5 seed with a hard-fought 27-24 win Sunday against Arizona.
By the way, I would like to officially take back everything that I said about playing the Cardinals.
Thank you. I mean, I said some of those things too, but you were a little more aggressive about it.
Anyway.
Well, I mean, that's one of my questions here. So first off, by the way, like the outcome of the game actually didn't matter, because by the time Sebastian Janikowski kicked his winning field goal, the Minnesota Vikings had already lost at home to the Chicago Bears in their season finale, making the Seahawks the 5 seed and the Philadelphia Eagles the 6 seed. The one nightmare scenario is if somehow Janikowski would have missed that field goal, they would have had to play overtime.
Oh my God,
the Cardinals.
I was pretty nervous about overtime in that one.
Yeah, that would have been the worst
possible thing. Nobody in the building wanted overtime.
So should we be concerned at all about what happened on Sunday?
No.
Just a flat no?
I mean,
we've seen it against the Cardinals not translate in the playoffs.
It's the Cardinals. It was a different offensive line than we're going to see this coming week.
Yes.
They started the game. Ethan Posick played for most of the game, which hopefully, knock on wood, we'll talk about injuries in a second, won't happen. What did they start with? I think Fant was playing.
Fant was at right tackle.
Fetty was
at
playing
right guard.
Yes. With Fant at right tackle, which is something that's not going to happen in this playoff game.
That is not, no.
It was a makeshift line, and
Russell Wilson was under siege on third down, sacked six times.
They didn't hold up particularly well, which I don't think will be the case again. There was maybe some bad luck in the game. It was just...
There was some bad special teams. There was definitely that.
It was just an ugly Cardinals game. It's a game that happens and you forget about. That's like saying in 2013, did the game against the Cardinals matter?
That was the year they lost in week 16.
Yeah, right?
And everyone panicked. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It didn't, but I think it also showed that
it never matters.
But I don't know that you can just say, oh, that game doesn't matter, but also the Seahawks game against the Chiefs is totally predictive of what they're going to do going forward.
I'm not saying that it is predictive, but we know what these Cardinals games look like.
We do.
The game on the road looked... I mean, they played an ugly, ugly game against the Cardinals on the road. Lost Earl Thomas at the end of the game. Like, one of the most demoralizing Seahawks games that we've seen. And from that moment forward was when the season really turned around. The next week, they played the Rams and played them exceptionally well.
Wait, okay.
Earlier this year.
I was thinking back to past seasons. I was like, wait, they didn't lose Earl Thomas. They lost Cam Chancellor and Richard Sherman.
That too.
Only those two members of the Legion of Boom. Only those two. Only that one Hall of Famer.
These Cardinals games don't matter. You just have to wipe them from your mind completely. Somehow, despite the fact that it's no longer Bruce Arians, Steve Wilks still managed to bring the same kind of energy to the stadium.
Keep that same energy against the Seahawks. You mentioned
it's completely irrelevant.
You mentioned the offensive line. Let's get to the injury update going into this week, and it looks pretty positive for the most part. There will be no injury designation for DJ Fluker, Shaquille Griffin, who sprained his ankle during that game and left, or Tedrick Thompson after all of those players practiced fully on Thursday. J.R. Sweezy is questionable. It'll be a game-time decision, but has a good chance, according to Pete Carroll. And then Trey Madden is doubtful with a hamstring injury.
Which kind of a little bit like, thank God.
You know, it's been some good Trey Madden moments, but also he probably wasn't going to play as much in this game anyway, because part of the reason he's seen increased action in the last couple of weeks is because George Fant hasn't been available as a tight end.
Yeah. A sixth offensive lineman.
The one
It saves the Seahawks from themselves just a little bit.
Just a little bit. The one bad news on the injury front is that Delano Hill suffered a crack in his hip during the Arizona game and was placed on IR. So,
because, of course.
There was some question as to whether, even with Tedrick Thompson coming back, whether you might consider might stick with Hill at strong safety, Bradley McDougal at free safety. That option obviously now off the table.
It sucks because I think Delano Hill looked pretty good the last few weeks.
Yeah.
And the combo of him and McDougal seemed pretty solid. I mean, they managed to be the likely MVP winner with that combination in the secondary. At the same time, Tedrick does have a lot of experience playing this year.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty indifferent between those two combos. I don't have a strong feeling either way. Let's get to the Cowboys.
But most importantly, I do think that Sweezy playing, which is a wild thing to say, that Sweezy playing is going to be hugely important in this game.
I mean, you did see them have a strong offensive line game. To go back to your whole, they beat the Chiefs and the MVP favorite. Well, they did that with Ethan Posick playing the entire game.
That was a very different defense than they're going to be facing this week.
Yes. But I also think that the combination of Ifedi playing a position he hasn't played in a long period of time,
yes,
and Fant, like that compared to getting Sweezy and Ifedi back on the right side. I mean, Fant and Ifedi, I don't know, I have a strong feeling about, but Ifedi out of position and Fant, I don't think that was a great combo.
No, that was bad.
Yeah.
But I do think the difference between Sweezy and Posick is pretty good. I think there's a pretty big difference between the two, and then just having Posick as an available lineman.
So the other case where there was a big difference between the two is, we talked about last week, the importance of Sunday's game for the Seahawks was that you definitely would much rather be the number 5 seed and travel to Dallas than be the 6th seed and travel to Chicago. Weather, quality of team, all of those huge differences. Dallas was 3-5 at season's midpoint, including their loss in Seattle in week 3, but finished with 7 wins in their last 8 games, including a 7-2 record after trading for wide receiver Amari Cooper from the Raiders. However, they had a relatively weak schedule in that span. They faced 3 playoff teams, the Eagles twice and the Saints, among those eight games that included 7 wins. The 13-10 win over New Orleans was probably their best performance of the season, but none of those wins came by more than 8 points during the second half of the season. Their only win all year by more than one score was a 47 blowout of Jacksonville in week 6. All told, Dallas outscored opponents by less than a point per game, which would be more typical of an 8 or 9 win team than the 10 wins they actually got.
So tell us about the Cowboys.
So the Cooper trade obviously is a big dividing line in their season, and you can see it pretty dramatically in Dak Prescott's stats as a passer. Over the first 7 weeks of the season, he was completing 62% of his passes for 6.9 yards per attempt, and threw interceptions on 1.9% of his passes. Then over the last 9 weeks with Cooper in the lineup, his completion percentage has shot up to 71% and 7.7 yards per attempt. His interceptions down to 1.3% of his passes. So if you look at what a big difference that is, his completion percentage with Cooper would have ranked 2nd in the NFL behind Drew Brees. And his yards per attempt went from 25th, tied for 25th in the league in the first 7 games, to tied for 11th in the league over the last 9. They did face a relatively easy set of defenses, would have ranked on average about 22nd or 23rd in pass defense DVOA in terms of the teams they faced with Cooper in the lineup. So that's part of, they played an easy set of defenses all year, which is part of why their passing DVOA is down at 26th, much worse than their yards per attempt. The other factor there is their offensive line, long a strength of the Cowboys, at least in terms of pass protection, has become a weakness this season. They are 28th overall in adjusted sack rate, nearly 10% of Dak Prescott's dropbacks. That dropped a little after the Cooper trade, but not dramatically.
Yeah, and this to me is one of the big differences in Dak Prescott this year, where he's been compared to Russell Wilson his entire career, and finally the sack rate caught up with him, where it's like, Russell's used to this. He was born into this. He's been sacked a ton his entire career. But Dak Prescott, during his record-breaking rookie season, was sacked basically none, right? Yes. He was at like a 5% sack rate. This year,
faced a little more pressure in the second half of last year when Ezekiel Elliott's suspension coincided with injuries on the offensive line that actually were probably a much bigger factor.
When his yards per attempt are down from that rookie season, and he's being sacked a ton. I mean, basically twice as much. And this is a huge place where the Seahawks defense, I think, can exploit the Cowboys.
And that was one of the exciting things that we did see against Arizona, was Jaron Reed and Frank Clark again making big plays as pass rushers. I mean, 10.5 sacks from an interior lineman for Jaron Reed, that's really awesome.
It's pretty crazy. It was like, it really came on at the end of the year.
Yes, it definitely did.
But you have that coupled with the injury to, I don't know how to pronounce the dude's name. Suafilo.
Oh, Xavier Suafilo.
Yeah. I pronounced that right.
Yeah.
Okay. To Xavier Suafilo, where it's like, this Seahawk defensive line is going to get to Dak, and probably early and often.
That does seem likely, and that's going to be an important thing. I mean, you've also, somewhat like Russ, got it. He's not probably as effective as a scrambler, but you do have to contain him in that same way, and that will be a challenge for the Seahawks defense. But
and so part of that is why their offense, in a little bit of a way, looks kind of mirror image to what the Seahawks do, really trying to run the ball a lot.
Yes, but not nearly as effectively. They're 19th in rushing DVOA as compared to the Seahawks being 7th in rushing DVOA. Ezekiel Elliott, he rates about average on a per-play basis in terms of DVOA. He led the NFL in attempts by a wide margin with 43 more than Saquon Barkley. That's as large a difference as between Barkley and number 10 in the league, Christian McCaffrey. So he had huge volume, but not necessarily that great on a per-play basis. They really just rode him. His backup, Rod Smith, a former Seahawk, had 44 carries, and nobody else besides Dak had more than 6 carries all season for the Cowboys. Dak, below average in terms of broken tackle rate and yards after contact at the time that third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin wrote about the best running backs in the NFC, and really did not figure prominently in that article, which focused on how well Chris Carson does, in fact, rate among those NFL running backs. We've seen a few times this year where DVOA and then the expected points added model that ESPN uses in QBR have a difference of opinion on quarterback rushing, Russell Wilson being one of those cases. That's the case also with Dak Prescott, who ranks 6th among QBs in rushing value according to QBR, but 13th according to DR, the DVOA total value. He has the 6th most total rushes among quarterbacks.
The other thing about this Cowboys offense, to me, is that they run this sort of kind of similar to what the Seahawks are doing thing. They definitely pass the ball more. I think Dak had about 100 more pass attempts than Russell had this year. But
they're also not as like deep ball dependent. I mean, you look at the way they've played the last few weeks. You know, there's a lot of yards after the catch from Amari Cooper, but it's shorter, higher completion percent, higher percentage passes.
When to run that kind of offense, you basically have to never turn the ball over. And that's kind of what has made the Seahawks so successful doing this. And what has made this Russell Wilson season so unique. Granted, there's only one more interception for Dak, and I think his interception rate is better than Russell's. But the Cowboys in their last 6 weeks have forced 10 turnovers, same as the Seahawks. Their turnover margin, though, during that time period is only +3 because of all the giveaways on offense, whereas the Seahawks are at +8 during that exact same time period.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an encouraging sign.
And I mean, I think they have the same record during those last, I think they're both 5-1 during those last six games, and both coming into, there's like stat, like the best record over those games in the league for both these teams.
But when you look at actual performance adjusted for opponent, the Seahawks are in a totally different ballpark over that span than the Cowboys are. The Cowboys have really just been about an average team over that period. We haven't talked about Amari Cooper's performance himself. He's been targeted on about a quarter of Dak Prescott's passes since coming over and has caught 70% of those targets for 9.5 yards per target, which is really good. It turns out when Amari Cooper, I mean, I don't want to go too far about Dak Prescott's quarterback ability. When he plays with a better quarterback than Derek Carr, he's a really, really effective receiver. Alan Hearns, who started the year when the Seahawks played them, he was still a pretty important part of the Cowboys offense. He's been targeted just 8 times in the last 9 weeks after Cooper's arrival. But the player who is still involved on the other side is a outside wide receiver, is rookie Michael Gallup. And you probably want to be excited when the Cowboys target him in the pass game. He's caught just 49% of his targets this season, and he made some big plays to compensate for that in the first 7 weeks of the season. Those have largely dried up since Amari Cooper's arrival. He's just been bad.
I mean, he's a rookie wide receiver. True. I'm still a little bit skeptical.
He's kind of their David Moore.
David, don't you dare say that about David Moore. People are really down on David Moore right now.
Have you looked at David Moore's catch rate lately? I tweeted about it on Sunday. He did have two catches and two targets after that tweet. So
pretty
good for
skeptical
him.
About the Amari Cooper thing, though.
Are you?
Because if you look at basically what he's done since he's got to Dallas, is there are two games that are widely impacting this. But here's yards per game since he got to Dallas. 58, 75, 36, 180, 76, 217, 32, 20, 31.
Okay, so you're telling, but first off, I mean, you look at those overall stats, you know that he's opening things up. He has gravity as a receiver that's opening things up for other players. But number two, he basically single-handedly won those two games. So there's a possibility that he can do that. We've seen the Seahawks secondary get dunked on like that.
There's a possibility that he can do it, but saying that it's likely that out of 9 games, he's had 2 good games, like...
People are giving too much
credit to Amari Cooper for 2 good games. Like saying that Amari Cooper
The overall stats are what they are.
Saying that he's worth a first round pick for playing good in 2 games. Like where was that gravity that he was creating when they were losing 23-0 to the Colts?
It was not there. I hope this looks more like that game.
I mean, but his last 3 weeks have looked like that. Maybe teams were looking past them. I mean, there was a very beat-up Eagles secondary that he torched for those 217 yards. This was not a starting Eagles secondary, which somehow made the playoffs.
Did you watch the Carolina game? Did you watch the Seahawks play Carolina? Feeling
they do a whole different type of thing. What the Panthers do is so different than what the Cowboys do with their ability to stretch the field. Like, North Turner ain't walking through that door.
Cowboys, yeah, they might wish he is.
But I mean, when you look at these last 3 weeks, it's like 5 receptions on 11 targets for 31 yards against the Giants secondary. This is your savior?
Cole Beasley was the savior last week. That was an amazing catch.
I thought it was Blake Jarwin. You don't even know about this Blake Jarwin game, do you?
I do. I really don't.
It was a monster fantasy performance in week 17. He had 1, 2, 3 touchdowns. Yeah, Blake Jarwin had 119 yards and 3 touchdowns. Maybe it was because Amari Cooper was opening up, or maybe it was because they were playing the Giants.
Either of those could be possible.
Anyway, I'm just a little bit skeptical of the Amari Cooper thing and that we need to be fearing him like he's a number one receiver. He's still Amari Cooper.
Okay. Well, the overall stats are what they are. Blake Jarwin had 3 touchdowns last week?
Hell yeah, he did.
Wow.
Should have played him in fantasy. You would have beaten me.
So much for the Rico Gathers breakout. I guess that one's not happening anytime soon.
He's no CJ Anderson.
I mean, the other side of the football is actually Dallas's. They have been a top 10 defense this season, despite the fact that in the past they were terrible anytime that Sean Lee was injured, and Sean Lee has been injured most of the season. He's, you know, not really played many full games. Last week played 22 snaps against the Giants, his most extensive action since October.
Since Golden Tate wrecked him.
I suppose so. Still limited in practice this week by his hamstring injury, but he will play, it sounds like. Lee was kind of replaced now by the emergence of Jalen Smith, who they drafted in the second round out of Notre Dame after he was injured and waited around and very effectively.
Why didn't we draft him?
I mean, that was pretty high. I think when Seahawks Twitter was talking about drafting him, we were talking about drafting him in like the third or fourth round, not in the second round. But it proved a brilliant decision by the Cowboys. And then also rookie Leighton Vander Esch, who racked up a lot of tackles, although there's still some skepticism. Third cousin brother Mina Kimes notably skeptical of Vander Esch's stats.
Really?
Yeah.
Did she say that?
She did on her podcast this week.
Interesting.
Yeah.
She was still... Still wish the Seahawks had him.
I mean, yeah. He could be overrated because he's rated really high. Nobody's rated Rashad Penny that high at this point.
Oh, God. After last week's performance, remember when I asked you if he should be the feature back? They would have lost 23-0 to the Cardinals if he would have been.
The Cowboys, so the strength of this defense, here's the bad news for the Seahawks. The strength of this defense is their rush defense. They are fifth in rushing DVOA. This is the first defense the Seahawks have played that ranks in the top nine in rushing DVOA since Chicago in week two. They've played a bunch of cupcake rushing defenses, and that has helped Chris Carson win NFC.
Is NFC Player of the Month Chris Carson plus Blake Jarwin? That's how you get NFC Offensive Player of the Month.
I was going win in Carson there. That's what I was combining. That's
part
of what
Jarwin does. Blake Jarwin.
Yeah, that used to be Dat Nguyen back in Dallas. But here's the one encouraging sign for the Seahawks is that this Cowboys defense was gashed for 178 yards on 39 carries by the Colts in their only loss during these last eight games. That's the game you're looking to replicate, yeah. Especially because of the 23-0 final.
And you know what I do when I'm looking at a team to scout them is I look at the one really bad loss and ignore all the wins around it.
That's why the Dallas is basing everything on blocking two punts this weekend. You didn't like that joke?
We still won that game. They should look more about trying to make Sebastian Janikowski make more tackles.
I guess that's true. I can't dispute that.
Do you think that on the ground it could look very similar to the game that these two teams played earlier in the year? You know, it's like we talk about how these teams look so different than they did then. But really, like when I look at the box, when I look back at this box score from week three against the Cowboys, I'm like, this kind of looks like what these teams are still.
Again, you just don't think Amari Cooper matters at all?
I don't think Amari Cooper matters all that much. Like, is he that big of a difference? But I'm talking more about the Seahawks offensively,
yes.
Where Carson got 32 carries in that game for 100 yards, and that came after those two losses. And if Brian Schottenheimer ran him any less than 30 times, he would have gotten the John DeFilippo treatment so quickly. In this game.
Mike Zimmer still was talking about running the ball more last week. Like, oh, never change Mike Zimmer. Never change. Do change Pete Carroll, but never change Mike Zimmer. I think that is a reasonable expectation for the Seahawks to run the ball a lot and not for that many yards per carry.
And, you know, the thing that they did well in that game was they ran the ball and then they hit Tyler Lockett deep.
They sure established that run.
And teams are able to pass the ball against this Cowboys defense.
They are. They rank their average overall in terms of passing defense, despite kind of the hype about Chris Richard's influence on this defense coming in as co-defensive coordinator with Rod Marinelli.
That's future head coach Chris Richard to you.
It seems very likely so. They've gotten pretty good play from their boundary corners, but really anywhere else in terms of coverage has been a weakness for them. And then the other thing, Rod Marinelli usually does a terrific job of cobbling together a pass rush out of the stuff that MacGyver used to create something. Wow, that was a timely reference.
Yeah. Well, it will put end timely.
Yes, it was. Great
stuff
all around.
That MacGyver used to make something.
I don't know. They're 27th in adjusted sack rate this season. DeMarcus Lawrence is the only player with more than six sacks on the roster, although you do need to watch out for Jalen Smith blitzing Bobby Wagner style. He's got four sacks this season.
I will watch for that.
Okay, keep an eye out.
You know, the interesting thing for me about these two teams, and especially the Cowboys on defense, is they rank really well statistically. But on third down, they've been one of the worst teams in the league.
So they're the anti-Seahawks.
As far as getting teams off the field.
They're the terrible good defense as opposed to the good terrible defense.
The Cowboys are allowing 42% of third downs to be picked up to the Seahawks 35, which ranks them 27th in the league.
That's good because you know who likes third downs? Shoddy. He's playing for that third manageable.
I mean, that to me, if you're looking for kind of, when you look at the game plan, you're like, okay, this team defends the run really well. They do well against outside receivers. They don't do very well against running backs coming out of the backfield, tight ends, third receivers. And you're like, wow, that's a pretty shitty recipe for the Seahawks.
It is.
Because they are bad against the things that the Seahawks are bad at doing offensively. And they're good against the things that the Seahawks are good at doing offensively. Are they that good? You know, this is not like one of the best. This is not the Bears or whatever, where they're so good that you can't throw the ball to Baldwin and Lockett
right.
or whatever, and you can't run the ball. I mean, they managed to get to 100 yards on those 32 carries.
They sure did.
It wasn't like it was a 32 carry for 64 yard type of performance. Yes. But, you know, they're not so excellent at those things that you can't do them. But if you're looking for a glimmer of hope against this defense, it is that third down where if the Seahawks can just stay on the field, keep picking up first downs and eventually score and get the Cowboys off the field in a way that their defense is. I mean, the Cowboys are giving up more third downs than their offense is getting. They have a negative third down margin, whereas the Seahawks are plus like 4%.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a lot of negative margins. The Cowboys are just not that good, but they are at home and that matters. And that's why they're favored by 2 points, which still I think is a little optimistic for Dallas.
It seems like it's going down.
It has been trending downward since it was originally posted. I think an important thing in this game is just going to be who establishes an early lead.
Because I thought you were going to say who establishes the run. Both teams! Everybody's establishing the run.
Run established. Because both of these teams want to run the ball and then hit play action against you. Neither of these teams want to rely on their quarterback. One of the teams correctly so, the other team not so correctly so. But one of these teams is going to get a chance to use the game plan they want, and the other isn't. It's going to have to adjust on the fly.
What if they both get to use the game plan they want?
So if it stays close the entire game?
It could be ugly.
Oh, so you're saying it's like a 10-10 game?
No, I don't think it'll be that
ugly. The weird thing, by the way, is that the Seahawks-Cardinals game, it was so bad offensively, and yet there were so many points scored.
Were there so many points scored?
The final was, what, 27-24?
20-17? I don't even remember. I've blocked it from my mind forever.
Yeah, it was 27-24. There was 51 combined points scored. The Cardinals scored 24 points while averaging like 4 yards per pass attempt.
That's pretty bad. I mean, they got a punt touchdown.
They did, yes. It was a weird game.
It just, looking at this game, you look at the history of the Seahawks in their first playoff game under Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson. Undefeated under Pete Carroll, undefeated under Russell Wilson.
That is accurate.
Pete has the one extra game in there, the Beastquake win. But you have a history of the Seahawks going at teams in this wild card round that they're better than. And winning those games, sometimes comfortably when the opposing quarterback breaks his knee forever. Sometimes it involves a very easy missed field goal. However it's happened, but the Seahawks have managed to win those games. And in the same vein, the ones at home where they're able to come out kind of, I don't know, sort of rope-a-dope the Lions in that one, right?
Yes. Kind of similar to the Carolina game, too.
This is the exact type of game that the Seahawks have played over and over and over again in the playoffs. This is not going at Carolina. This is not going at Atlanta. This is not the type of game where they have to do anything all that different than they're comfortable doing.
So are you arguing that the Seahawks should be favored in this game? Because that's what it sounds like you're arguing to me.
I mean, I'm going to have a greater than 50% percentage chance of victory.
Okay.
Because they're just a way better team.
They're a better team.
As a matter of fact, they are a better team than the Cowboys are by pretty much any metric. So I don't know if they should be favored. Are they 3 points better? I don't know. It should be pretty even. They're probably about 3 points better.
Okay.
If this game was in Seattle, the spread would be more than 3 points. How about that?
No, for sure. I mean, that's the fact that it's less than 3 points implies that it would be at least be four.
I mean, I think if this game was in Seattle, the Seahawks would be a 6-point favorite.
Which would imply then that they should be about even on the road. There's also the fact that, I mean, we haven't talked about this. Russell Wilson will not be touched by rain in this game. That's important. Playing on turf, where the Seahawks are usually quite effective on the road.
I mean, in Dallas.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I mean, when you look at the Cowboys, they were a much better team last year than they are this year. And granted, the stats are kind of looking at the full season before the offensive line broke down, before Zeke was suspended. But the Cowboys were, like, they finished 9th in DVOA last year and 22nd this year.
Yeah.
And the Seahawks went in there and pretty comfortably won on Christmas Eve. I don't know. I know why we're scared, because the stakes are very high, but this is a team that they're better than and should beat.
I don't know if I'm going to go so far as to say they should beat them. I think you're about right. I had this as a 50-50 game. I think the Seahawks are about a 3-point better team. And then when you account for home road, it makes it a toss-up, which is a fun playoff game.
The things that can't happen in this game are, and sort of the recipe for victory for the Seahawks, is no turnovers, no blocked punts, no kick return touchdowns. They just can't give up garbage. Like, this has to be, if there ever was a game that Pete Carroll could Pete Carroll should be Pete Carrolling this game, right? Of all games, this is what he does. He takes teams, and this is what you talked about Pete Carroll's very bad at playing like an underdog.
We're going to get to that in a second. People are bad at playing like underdogs.
This is a game where he doesn't have to play it like an underdog.
No.
And because of that, if the Seahawks can just execute and avoid any terrible errors or any things going horribly awry, they should win this game pretty comfortably.
Comfortably?
I'm giving them a 60% chance of winning.
Wow. That is very optimistic. That is like Cable Thanos video levels of optimism.
And if they...
I mean, I think it's hard to ever be that big of a favorite on the road in the playoffs.
Well, sure. I mean, Vegas would never set the line that high.
No.
But they'll be able to move the ball. They'll be able to pass the ball. They'll be able to run the ball a little bit. This is going to be a comfortable game for the Seahawks offense.
I am, in fact, going 50-50. The other thing that concerns me, besides Amari Cooper streaking through the Seahawks secondary and some sort of special teams miscue, is the Cowboys getting a crucial long field goal from Brett Maher. They're not good on special teams. They're really mediocre across the board, and including on field goal kicking. But he's got a huge leg. Has made field goals of 59 and 62 yards this season. And the Seahawks bend but break defense might be conceding a lot of 50-plus yard field goals. I can see that. It's a possibility.
Okay. You should be more worried about Dak being sacked all the time.
The Seahawks
are going to sack Dak 6-plus times in this game.
Oh, I hope so. Is that a bold prediction?
I've got a bold prediction coming for you later.
Okay.
I want you to add it to the list.
I will be happy to do so. Anything else on this game?
Man, I'm just fired up we're here.
We should take a second. Like, hey, I mean, we celebrated the Seahawks being in the playoffs with the Chiefs post-game pod, but still, the playoffs, man. We weren't counting on this. There was a chance we could be talking about a ramen bracket right now.
Goddamn ramen bracket.
Look, I'm excited about the ramen bracket, but the ramen bracket can wait. We got playoffs to attend to.
The ramen bracket can wait till February.
Okay, let's wrap things up with discussing the Seahawks 28-23 loss.
Huskies.
Yeah. The Huskies 28. First off, they are the baby Seahawks. The Huskies 28-23 loss to Ohio State in the Rose Bowl. Should I do a second here on the experience of attending my first Rose Bowl? There are a lot of hyped things in this world where the hype is meaningless. The Rose Bowl is something that is tremendously hyped more than anything else in college football. It totally lives up to it. Like, there is just something about the field is somehow a brighter shade of green than any other football field I have ever seen in my life.
At the Rose Bowl.
Yeah.
Do you think it's the same if you're not watching the Rose Bowl, but you're at the Rose Bowl?
No, I don't think. It's probably not quite the same if it's a UCLA game, no. But the Rose Bowl, there's just, yeah.
How are your seats, by the way?
Very high up. Uh-huh. I was three rows from the top.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to be in the last row to follow tradition.
Yeah.
I was in the Ohio State end zone, kind of opposite where the Ohio State, I think, student section was in the band, and like the complete other side of the field from the UW band. I was on the sideline where most of the UW fans were, in the UW sideline. But the one downside of the Rose Bowl being as giant as it is like you can't even hear the Husky band from the other side of the field.
Really?
As opposed to like at Husky Stadium, we can hear them clearly from where we sit in the opposite end zone. Yeah, I mean, we're not as high up because there's not 77 rows going back.
But it's just one straight row back.
Yes.
That's pretty crazy.
It is.
They just don't design stadiums like that anymore.
They don't. I mean, it was designed a very long time ago.
Were you sitting with anybody?
No.
Were you able to freak out as much as you wanted to freak out at the game?
I was very intentionally not freaking out.
Okay.
Remaining calm the entire time.
Okay.
So it was a mix where, so I was not in a UW section. I was in a mix of Ohio State fans and UW fans.
What would you consider the ratio of UW to Wazzy fans or to Ohio State fans? Hopefully there weren't.
I heard
there was,
so I heard from Nate and Alicia that there were some Wazzy fans at Disneyland, and they were wondering if it was people that had bought like their trips.
And they're just like, we're going to Disneyland.
Yeah, going either way.
Please, let that be
the most amazing possibility. It was a slight edge to Ohio State, but it was not a dramatic edge. It was the other really fascinating thing that I didn't necessarily expect. So I was staying down near LA Live, where the Staples Center is, because of the fact that I went to the Clippers and Lakers games the following two nights. And then that's also where the ESPN offices are. So that was kind of a home base for me. And like LA Live was completely taken over on New Year's Eve by Ohio State and UW fans. I don't know where the Ohio State team hotel was, but the UW team hotel was right there at LA Live.
Interesting.
So I walked through that, and like literally everyone in there is wearing purple.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was a fun experience to see on the road.
How much do you think it dominated like travel to the city? Because I was trying to explain to our mom. She was talking about how you'd never be able to get a hotel or whatever. It was like, he's in like the second biggest city in the United States. Like, the amount of people that are at this game seems like a lot or whatever, but like,
which is 90,000 plus.
It's enough but people, yes, to like clog up flights from Seattle to LA.
Yes, but in the grand scheme, even my flight home
Los
tonight,
Angeles, it's not that many people.
Yes. I mean, that area, though, like I say, you know, even my hotel, which is a couple blocks removed from actual LA Live, I'd say, you know, probably the nights of New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, like that period of time, at least one third of the people were wearing either Ohio State or UW gear.
Huh.
So it definitely was like, you knew that the Rose Bowl was going on just from like walking around and seeing all the people.
Interesting.
So the only downside is trying to get out of there is a cluster. Like I thought it was like,
Did you lift there?
I did. Yes.
Okay.
I lifted to like where they had a shuttle from transit to there.
Okay.
A classic Peldenkast sneak. and then caught a ride home with the Millers on the way
and
back.
And they drove?
Yes.
Interesting. They like rented a car?
Yes.
Interesting.
Fortunately, where they were parked was like easy to get out. Could see how you could spend several hours trying to get out of that parking lot if you were on the other side.
Fun.
Yeah.
That's funny that you say that. I mean, you were at the game, so the experience is different. For me, I'm just like, fuck the Rose Bowl. There should have been a playoff.
I mean, it's interesting.
The Rose Bowl means nothing to me
like
anymore.
Nationally, the consensus is the playoff games were super boring. The New Year's Day games were much better. The Rose Bowl had a chance to be super boring, but fortunately it wasn't.
It is kind of ironic that it ended up being closer. But it's such a like reactionary perspective where you're like, because we only took four teams, these games were boring. Whereas a 4-5 game might have been incredibly interesting, or a 3-6 game might have been incredibly interesting. Right? It's just that Alabama and Clemson are so good right now that if whomever they play is going to be boring.
Yes.
So, like, I just feel like that's such a, like, ridiculous perspective to say.
But also the college football playoff can't possibly have the tradition and excitement of the Rose Bowl. It just is not possible. Ugh. And particularly if you're playing the championship game in Santa Clara.
Oh, man.
Which, speaking of a cluster to get to, well, would you rather go to Pasadena 10 times than Santa Clara?
It seems like it's kind of a cluster all around because nobody wants to go there.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, both of the teams who are playing, they should probably just play the championship game in the Southeast.
But if they played it at the Rose Bowl, I think people would be more excited to go to LA.
You're just like, we need to have this closer to Silicon Valley. Everybody loves there. And Larry Scott make this decision. And anything that happens in Santa Clara is a bad thing. Nobody wants to go to fucking Santa Clara. Can the people of the world stop putting things there?
What about the College of Santa Clara? Like, is that so bad?
Gone! Get rid of it. Oh, no. You're out of here, Broncos.
Oh, boy.
I'm just saying, at that
stadium. Steve Nash is going to be really upset.
Nobody wants to go to that stadium.
Yes, no, I agree. And it's not a college football venue, which is why, of course, they pay the Pac-12 championship game there.
It's in the middle of fucking nowhere. It's not in
San Francisco. I would say it's the middle of nowhere, but it's a long ways from San Francisco.
It's a hell of a long ways from South Carolina or Alabama.
That is also true. That's not what we're here to talk about, though. Should we talk about the, having discussed the experience, should we talk about the actual game? So the lowest moment, one of the things we did on the ride home was everyone said their peak and valley of the day.
That's fun.
And I love them. Even though I nominated it as my valley when I was trying to explain to the Ohio State fan in front of me that it was not offensive pass interference on the Gaskin touchdown because he caught the ball behind the line of scrimmage. And he just kept going, but the pass was forward. I'm like, yes, I get it. It was a pass, but it was caught behind the line of scrimmage. Like, that's how, like, screens are allowed.
You mean because players were blocking before
Yes. The
pass was called? Okay, they didn't even mention that in the broadcast. I didn't even know that was a talking point.
It only was among this one Ohio State fan in front of me.
And you engaged with him?
That was my first mistake.
I just would not engage with an
Ohio State fan. Just trying to be helpful. Like when I explained to the UW fans behind me that, no, don't be so upset about Sean McGrew calling for a fair catch. They're not getting the ball at the 5. Oh, they get the ball at the
25. For some reason, I really hate that rule. Just put the damn ball at the 25 if you're going to do that.
I mean, yeah, they probably should do that.
And kickoffs if that's going to
be the case. People were very upset about Sean McGrew fair catching even once they understood the Huskies got the ball at the 25. Like, believe me, the UW special teams were not going to get the ball past the 25. As we saw when they finally tried to return the punt returns. It's been a long year. Like, it's so weird.
It really has been a long year. For being such a successful season that they played in the Rose Bowl, I've had taken no joy from this Husky team. There was joy one time, just the Apple Cup.
Yes. Even the Pac-12 championship was not joyful.
No, there was no joy in this entire, which is a good, let's transition to the rest of the season. I'm going to talk about the Rose Bowl specifically first. Let's talk about how horrible the season was to watch later.
Well, but what I was going to say about the Rose Bowl, this is not yet my valley, is they just took everything that was frustrating about the entire 2018 season and just condensed it down into one game. Yes.
It was just a Husky game. Like,
it was the most Husky game.
It doesn't matter. It seems like this season, it hasn't necessarily mattered who the competition is because they've kind of done the same shit every week.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
I mean, there's sometimes where they were so much better than the opponent that they could still do their thing and win. But it's like, was this that different than the Cal game? Was this that different than the second half of the Stanford game? Was this that different than the Utah game? Was this that different from the Auburn game? Like, Ohio State...
The Auburn game was fairly different.
What happened in this game was so much more about the Huskies than it was about Ohio State.
I agree with that.
I mean, they were able to move the ball against the Husky defense better than... They were... They were able to move the ball. You're just telling people rules everywhere, telling me how to hold a microphone.
Well, if people are going to do it wrong.
Who am I, an Ohio State fan sitting in front of you? Anyway.
Look, I may well, actually, but I at least try to be correct when I will, actually.
Ohio State was able to move the ball against this Husky defense better than Cal was able to, right? Which is how they were able to an extended lead, to take the lead there.
That's Cheez-It Bowl loser, Cal, to you, good sir.
But the thing that was most important was that the Huskies were huskying all around the game.
So the low point for me really was Ohio State scores on their first drive of the second half to make it 28-3. And I'm just sitting there thinking, like, is everything I believed about this game, is everything I understood about statistical analysis just completely wrong here? And then it turned out over the remainder of the game that it wasn't wrong.
No, we really called a lot of the second half of the game, right? Like, what they did in that second half of the game, I feel like we really nailed that could happen.
And so, I mean, one of the interesting questions, like, this hasn't really come up, and I think you'd need to get the coaching staff on truth serum. Like, how much were they just playing the first half thinking, okay, let's keep this close, and then we're going to unleash some stuff in the second half?
Yeah.
Because, like, the Myles Gaskin jump pass, the fake sneak and pitch to Myles Gaskin, like, clearly Bush Hamden spent a lot of time working in the offensive staff.
You think that was a fake sneak? I mean,
yeah. It was 100% a fake sneak.
I mean, look, that was perfectly executed, right?
But it was like creative stuff that the Huskies haven't been doing all season.
Yeah.
But why did you save it for when they're down 25 points? Like, maybe unleash some of this. Granted, they didn't get to the goal line, but maybe on the 4th and 3, instead of kicking a field goal, maybe try running one of those plays.
You know, they really tried to. That's the thing. Do you want to do your peaks and valleys? Because I want to talk about this game.
That was my valley. I don't know. I mean, the peak was...
leaving?
No, the jump pass was the peak because it was so exciting.
Seeing,
that Miles Gaskin,
seeing the glow of the field.
I yelped by myself in the crowd. He passed it. Like, it's so amazing. We've been waiting for 4 years for him to pass it, and he finally did it in his final game.
That was pretty nice. I was really hoping when they did the Jake quick punt, I was like, he's going to pass a quick punt one time.
Oh, I didn't even consider that, and that didn't even cross my mind. I thought they were going to quick punt earlier in the game. I can't remember what the scenario was, but there was another potential quick punt scenario.
We really kind of got the whole Jake Browning era. But okay,
well, that we also got, yes, 100%.
The thing that they did try to do was, and I think Chris Peterson has been unfairly insulted for this. So, okay, here are the talking points from the media, right? Yes. Chris Peterson passed the ball at the end of the first half.
Yes.
Instead of running it to run out the clock.
Yes.
Which didn't go well.
It did go poorly. Yeah, they scored a touchdown. I mean, if it was 14-3, it would, in fact, have been a very different game in the second half.
Yeah, that didn't work out. But they needed to try something there.
I mean, I think what your point here is that the confusing, confounding thing with Chris Peterson is there's not always a coherence to his conservative and aggressive decisions. You know, because like he can never go for it, but then stick in Jake Haener as a backup quarterback in the middle of a road game that's you're up by 1 point. He can, you know, kick on 4th and 3 from the 20 in a game where you know you're going to need to score a lot of points against an Ohio State offense that's quite good, but then subsequently pass at the end of the first half instead of just running out the clock and forcing Ohio State to take their timeouts.
Now, the reason that I think that was might have been the wrong decision is even if you're picking up first downs there, the chances of getting to the end zone are still pretty difficult.
Yes.
So, look, I understand. I'm not saying it was a great decision or whatever. I don't think he should be as roasted for it as he was, though. Because, I mean, honestly, they missed a wide open pass.
Yes.
Like, there was, I don't know, I remember whether it was a drop or Jake missed
the pass. Jake missed it. That was the worst
pass. They did suffer from drops and a couple of missed passes, things like that, where it's just like, really? Like, in this of all games? But Ohio State did, too.
Yeah. No, I mean, Haskins had some pretty bad misses in the second half. But all of the analysis is hindsight-based. It's not process-based whatsoever.
That's
it's
what
all
I'm
based on the results.
But the other thing that he's being insulted for is the timeout and then the punt or whatever. Which, granted, that was bad. I'm not saying it wasn't bad. The thing that they should be most insulted for, and they mentioned it on the broadcast, is the first half game plan offensively.
Yes.
What were they thinking? Seriously, like, what is the logic there? Or when you realized that basically everything was horizontal, right? There was nothing vertical. Every single pass, Jake is turning sideways. And it's just like, what did they see that made them think that this was going to work? Because it didn't.
I mean, it did. It wasn't that bad. So I think one of the key takeaways for me from this game is, if you played this game 100 times, even with the exact same game plan and strategy, like, you don't change anything that Coach Pete isn't allowed to learn anything. You're just rerunning the game from scratch.
Coach Pete.
100 times. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You're rerunning this game from scratch 100 times. Like, you're hitting reset every time on the video game. I think that a lot of times...
It's raining really hard.
I think a lot of times the game goes very differently because... Basically, what happened is that Ohio State converted its yards into points way more effectively than the Huskies did.
Yes.
Ohio State had 7 3-and-outs in this game.
Yeah.
That is a shocking number for a team that scores 28 points.
They had a lot of those in the second half, but...
Yes, but they had 3 of them in the first half. Their first 2 drives were 3-and-outs. They had 1 first down in the final 23 minutes of the game, but they scored a touchdown every single time they advanced past the UW 35.
Really?
Yes.
And the Huskies scored
every time in the entire game. There was only one other time they got the ball beyond midfield and didn't score a touchdown. Meanwhile, the Huskies both settled for that field goal and missed a fourth down inside the Ohio State 25. Like,
and they got across midfield a lot.
Yeah, they consistently moved the ball and then just stalled out.
I'm telling you, this is what we had an argument about the good offense, and you were like, the good offense is running in play action. I'm like, no, the good offense is not running in play action. The good offense is what they did in the second half. The good offense is throwing the ball downfield, having some urgency.
Yeah, but that's what play action is. You're taking deep shots on play action.
They weren't even necessarily, and you came back and said, no, the good offense is passing on early downs.
Yes.
And it's like,
they did pass on early downs a lot in the first half. I will have to say that.
But they just did garbage passes.
Yes.
They didn't do real passes. It was so... And granted, a lot of stuff just worked better in the second half too. But
and the fact that they were down 25 probably was a factor to some extent in
getting
that.
Getting the ball downfield. That pass that they threw. Who was it who went up and made that catch? Was that Bocelli?
I think it was... No, it might have been Fuller. I can't remember though.
But giving a chance for your receivers who've made plays this
also
year.
Also playing Hunter Bryant, who is like Hunter your Bryant one player who can athletically deal with, like, be on a level playing field with Ohio State.
It's like they watched Sean McVay and took the exact wrong thing from what Sean McVay does. You go vertical able to use the horizontal.
I don't think it was a terrible game plan. I just think that there should have been some kind of adjustment. I don't think
when it wasn't working. There never is. There is at halftime. They are a good second half team, but they can't do it on the fly.
them and Mike Hopkins both.
They really are. Like, I went into this game with thinking that they had a chance of coming back in the second half. And if they didn't give up that first touchdown, the Huskies might have won this game.
It's possible. Yeah.
I mean, it was just such a bummer watching that last drive with like these huge plays, the Hunter Bryant one had to catch. And it's like, if this were an 8-point game, just like this would be so much fun. If this was a drive that could have tied the game or won the game for them, it would have been like one of the great drives in Husky history. And instead it was just something that happened before they didn't get an onside kick.
No, I don't agree with that because it's still,
because they covered the spread.
First off, yes, backdoor cover. But it also... It left on a much better taste than it would have been had they not converted that drive. It left Jake Browning felt like he had a much better game because of that. Just everything. It justified what we believed this Husky team could do all along.
That's the offense, and they never got it. They never got the offense all year. There was no one game where they really ran good offense. Maybe the Apple Cup.
BYU is just bad defensively.
But the Apple Cup, what they did, they didn't do this weird horizontal stuff, right?
No, they threw the ball downfield.
Get the damn ball downfield. And you know what the thing is? I think this is a similar thing to a shoddy Pete play calling issue or just all NFL coaches play calling issue. I think that for some reason they look at Jake Browning and he almost has like a stink on him, you know? Like Jacob Eason's the new girlfriend.
And I have many thoughts on this, but
I'm sure
they save
fucking
those in
hate
second.
Jacob Eason.
No, it has nothing to do with Jacob Eason. I hate the way we talk about Jacob Eason
as a freshman. Like,
but why is Jacob Eason so touted? Because of the fact that he was a top prospect. Hey, you know what else was a top prospect? Nick Fontana was a top prospect. Yeah, because he's tall and throws hard, and that's the wrong takeaway for what matters in college football or any football. That's why Josh Allen gets drafted in the top five.
Don't you dare talk bad about Josh Allen.
Look, he is a phenomenal running back, but as a quarterback, he leaves much to be desired. Maybe as a Wildcat running back, he is great.
I've come around full 360 on Josh Allen.
First off.
No, I started out loving him, then I didn't like him, and I'm back to loving him. That's a 360.
Okay.
He was my favorite quarterback in college football 2 years ago.
That is true.
Anyway, what they're going to do with Jacob Eason next year is going to be wildly different than what they did with Jake Browning this year. And they're probably going to stumble into a much better offense because of it.
I think they may go a 360 as well.
Especially because they know that they don't have the same kind of running backs that they had this year. They may find themselves with a much better offense next year, not because the quarterback is different, but because their perception of the quarterback is different.
But I'm also curious about this. So Adam Jude tweeted after the game, asked Chris Peterson if UW's offense needed a drastic overhaul in the offseason, and he said it needed to be, quote, fixed. How? We'll have a plan. We will. We'll study the hell out of the tape and pare things down so we're more precise at what we're doing. It all comes down to execution. And this, to me, is another sign that fundamentally they don't understand how good they were at offense.
Yes.
They dropped with that first half. They dropped all the way down to 18th. In offensive FPI efficiency. They were good. They just didn't know they were good. And that's why they played so conservative in the first half.
Yes.
Because they were like, we can't lose this game on offense. And therefore, by not losing the game, they lost it.
their perception of Jake Browning is closer to the dumb fans' perspective of Jake Browning than it is to the smart fans' perspective.
I don't know that I completely buy that, because like Coach Pete is very clear all the time that
he put in Jake Haener in a crucial game. I don't know if you need to be reminded of that.
But I think that's more because of the Jake every once in a while, like, and he got lucky this time that it got batted down by his offensive lineman just randomly throwing the ball up. Like, oh man. Look, I admit that's a problem. That's not good. But I mean, Chris Peterson has been very clear over time that the number two, the two top traits he looks for in a quarterback are decision making and accuracy, and those are the two things I value the most. And those are places where Jake Browning is better than Jacob Eason.
If we don't know that, though, you're just making this as a blanket statement without knowing it.
Based on the only objective criteria we have, he's better at it. Like, what else do you want me to go by? Like,
Jacob
the people telling tall tales about what he's doing with the scout team? Yeah, like, that's very a reliable predictor of success.
I mean, he has gone against very good players for the last
year. Here's here's my question is, who's going to be the scapegoat next year when people can't blame Jake Browning?
It's going to be Bushdam Hanum. Like it
no, it's
going to
be Eason, because his expectations, if he doesn't come in and throw for 500 yards and 7 touchdowns every game, people are going to be disappointed because they built him up into this thing that no one can be. It's not that he can't be it. No one can be that. I mean, except Tua. But he's not walking through that door.
If Jacob Eason is the starting quarterback next year, which we don't know that he will be.
I mean, but this is a thing. Like, Adam Jode wrote last week that it was a competition and people were like that, you know, he had to win the starting job. And people are like, what are you joking? Like, they treat Jacob Eason like he is the greatest quarterback of all time.
It probably comes a little bit. I mean, people love recruiting rankings. People also here have a complex about, like, the South, right? The thing is, the way that SEC wants to be treated or treats itself is the way that we treat them, and that's why they have that perception. We treat Georgia like it's this godly university, right? Same with the dude who came to UW from where? Kentucky? It's just like, he was at Kentucky. You know what I mean? It's like,
I'm not sure what you mean. You're talking about
Quade Green.
Quade Green. Did we ever talk about that on the podcast?
No, by the way. Congrats. Nice one, Hop.
No, he's legitimately potentially
very
good.
I'm sure that he is, but it's just like,
I have objective statistics on him.
Where it's like, he played for Georgia. Have you ever heard of them? It's like, they had Brian Schottenheimer as their offensive coordinator.
Not the same season, for the record.
But there is a thing where it's like, he was good enough to go to Georgia. Yeah. And it's like this like lack of self-esteem as UW, right? And as UW fans, like, we grew up with so much losing, unfortunately, that we're like, oh, we're UW and they're Georgia. You know? And, like, we need to get back to the point where it's like, yeah, this person got offered a scholarship by you fucking damn Dub. Right? And that savior's name is going to be Sam Heward.
You're damn right.
But the thing is, if Jacob Eason, I like we've already transitioned to the next year conversation. If Jacob Eason is the starting quarterback next year, he will be an accurate quarterback and a smart quarterback, because Coach Pete is not going to let him be the starting quarterback without it.
Okay, that's a fair point.
Have we ever seen him have an inaccurate quarterback?
I mean, I can't vouch for all of his Boise State teams. Year? The starting quarterback the first year for UW?
Yeah, who got kicked off the team from Colorado?
No, Siler Miles. He didn't get kicked off the team. He quit football. Mm. No, he 100% quit football. Mm-hmm. No.
Maybe. but
do you know something here?
No, that's just not how I remember the story being.
I think I know things here.
Oh, interesting.
No, I mean, I just know that they wanted him to continue playing, and he decided not to play.
I don't know if we remember every quarterback that Chris Peterson had at Boise State, but there was
really mostly just remember Kellen Moore.
There was a lot of Kellen Moore. And
did Jabron Hamden play for him?
Maybe. If it led to Bush Hamden, I'm upset about it.
How much more do you think Bush Hamden would have been criticized if people knew who Bush Hamden was? Because I think
if he was Sark, he would have been fired after the game.
Exactly.
Which,
like,
by the way, they should hire Sark as the offensive coordinator.
I mean, you know.
You knew this offense would be better with Sark as the offensive coordinator.
Of course it would
also
be better.
Wouldn't that be fun?
I don't think he's interested in that job.
Bring back Sark.
I think Sark is more likely to coach for the Seahawks than he is for the Huskies. For a variety of reasons.
For the Seahawks?
Like, I don't know. He'd be assistant to the head coach or something.
I don't think that's happening.
It's much more likely than him coaching for the Huskies.
Sure, of course, yes. I mean, it would be pretty embarrassing for him to come back as offensive coordinator after being the head coach.
There's just a variety of potential pitfalls to that.
Are you looking up Chris Peterson quarterbacks at Boise State?
I am. I mean, we don't have to pause for this. It's not that important.
Okay. But Chris Peterson is not going to go into the season with an inaccurate quarterback.
No, I mean, that is a strongest point. Oh, Jared Zabransky. Remember Jared Zabransky?
I think he was really good, too. No, he was the good. Dude who won the freaking Fiesta Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, completed 66% of his passes for 9 yards an attempt.
And he flipped the ball behind his back to Ian Johnson.
He sure did. Yeah, the next year is 68% from Taylor Tharp. And then Kellen Moore took over with Bush Hamden as his backup. 69
was the backup.
Yeah, he never played. 69, 64, 71% completion.
And was the all-time leader in passing yards in college football.
And then 74% for Kellen Moore as a senior.
God, why did he get better but Jake never did?
That's a fair question. Joe Southwick completed 67% of his passes during the year they beat Keith Price and UW in the Las Vegas Bowl. And then 69% from Grant Hedrick during Coach Pete's final year at Boise State.
So those were all pretty good.
Yes.
He never had an inaccurate passer. And I don't think he's going to be like, well, fans love Jacob Eason, so he's the starter.
I think the one question would be whether they like promised him the starting job when he transferred here.
Then let him go. Do you think Chris Peterson is so concerned with promising him the starting job that he's going to lose games because of it?
I also don't think Chris Peterson is the type of person who would, coach rather, who would promise a starting job to anyone.
Anyway, what about the rest of the team as we head into next year?
So
it was a joyless season.
But obviously the Huskies lose Jake Browning and Miles Gaskin on offense, as well as Drew Sample, and then Caleb McGarry is the fourth senior starter on offense.
But Kate Otten is coming back.
Kate Otten sure is. Sure is. They lose seven starters on defense, plus Taylor Rapp, who declared after the game that he is entering the day after the game that he's entering the NFL draft.
Also, we didn't talk about this at all. How big of a deal do you think it was that Taylor Rapp didn't play?
I mean, Ohio State did seem to pick on the precise area of the field in the red zone that Taylor Rapp would have been in.
It was most of the game, it didn't matter except for like three super key plays.
But that's sort of how football works.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was disappointing.
And also, just like you find out the day of the game,
yes.
Like I hate college football that you just don't know any of this going in.
It makes it extra frustrating. And then Byron Murphy is also a potential NFL draft candidate. He said before the Rose Bowl that he received a second round grade from the NFL Draft Advisory Committee, which tends to be pretty conservative with these sort of things. I would expect him to be a first round pick.
Go to the NFL. You're an NFL cornerback.
Yes,
do it. Both of them. I think Taylor Rapp is rated as like the fifth safety by Mel Kiper.
I mean, he's generally considered a late first round pick.
Better talk to your boy then.
Yeah, I don't have that kind of pull with Mel. Weirdly.
I do not think that he, if that is the case, they're not five safeties going in the first round.
Probably not.
It seemed to me.
You know where Taylor Rapp would fit well?
This is my bold prediction. Do you want to hear my other Husky bold prediction?
Yeah, what's your other bold prediction?
My bold prediction is that in the Pelton Cast Fantasy League.
You're going to beat me?
No. This is a Husky-related bold prediction. In the first round of the playoffs, Miles Gaskin will be starting in the Fantasy League.
I compared him to Philip Lindsay yesterday. I think that's a good comparison.
Mark that down wherever you mark bold predictions. Because if I get that right...
I mean, that would be a pretty good bold prediction
want for that.
To get right. So I would say that I'm pretty concerned about the defense, which looks like it's probably going to lose nine. You know, I would say there are 12 starters because, you know, I guess maybe there's really 11, but Miles Bryan is clearly a starter as the nickel corner. But nine of those players losing them, that's a lot.
It is
a lot of grit, really good players. I mean, obviously the secondary is going to, you could potentially lose all four, you know, non nickel corner starters plus Greg Gaines plus Ben Burkervin. Like that's a lot.
So it'll definitely take some time. Maybe I'm too optimistic about this. Maybe I have too much faith in the Coach Pete defensive regime, but we've been concerned about losing defensive players in the past. Maybe not this high of a volume of them.
I mean, the first year that was this high of a volume, when it was Shaq Thompson, it was Marcus Peters, who obviously was off the team midseason. It was Buda Baker and Danny Shelton.
Danny Shelton.
Like, that's an amazing set of talent.
Was it all those players? Did they lose Buda that year, too? I thought Buda was later.
I'm pretty sure they were all the same year.
I think Buda was drafted 2 years ago, and Shaq was like 4 years ago.
I mean,
you're wrong with that.
Yeah, I guess Shaq may have come in. Buda may have come in after Shaq. But there was definitely three first-round picks, or three top two picks.
And the defense got better after that.
Did it?
Yeah.
I mean, it definitely wasn't as good that next year as it would become subsequently. Oh, it's Kakaha was the other person we were remembering from that team. Yeah, so that was four of the first 44 picks in the NFL
There's
draft
be
on
a
defense.
There's a lot of Huskies in the NFL.
there are. That is accurate.
Which is pretty cool, especially that are drafted relatively high.
Yes.
Because, I mean, from this defense, Rapp and Byron Murphy, if Byron Murphy goes out, will be certainly drafted within the first three rounds. I think Miles Gaskin will be drafted. I think Greg Gaines will be drafted.
No, I guess they were really good on defense in 2015. They were ninth in the country in defensive FBI that year.
Is there anybody else who's going out who we think? Is Trey Adams coming back?
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
He announced that as he was coming back from injury. Yeah.
So I just have so much faith in this Coach Pete regime of being able to just replace players on the fly. Like, you can think of the generation, especially of cornerbacks, where you're like, oh, they'll never be replaceable. And then it's just like, boom, an even better player appears. And I don't know if I see any reason for that to have stopped.
To me, it's the challenge of doing it with so many players at the same time. If you're doing it with like three or four guys, yeah. Because other
There's
guys step up and become
line
leaders.
Coming though, there is some aggressive pass rush coming. Granted, they're going to be young, but they're probably going to be the defensive line that is coming in is going to be better than the defensive line that left.
Greg Gaines better than Greg Gaines?
Greg Gaines doesn't necessarily provide a lot of speed.
Yeah, but fine. I can grant that I buy that the edge rush is going to be better next year. But they've gone in that role from.
By the way, Ohio State should have run the ball every single play.
They were very effective running the ball. Shelton to Vita Vea to Greg Gaines. I mean, who's stepping up in that role next season?
We don't know yet. That's the thing. We don't know yet. We didn't know that it would be Greg Gaines when it was Greg Gaines.
No, we did know because he was playing alongside Vita Vea.
It's an opportunity issue. This is going to be a good defense. They have four-star players who are going to be coming in and playing. A lot of players who have experience, too.
Yeah, but I just don't know that the players who have experience are at the level of the players who are departing. I mean, I hope it's true, but I think this is going to be too much even for the Coach Pete.
Well, they'll have a relatively
Coach Kwiatkowski combo.
And Jimmy Lake.
Yeah.
They'll have a relatively easy non-conference schedule to kind of ease their way into the season. And hopefully, if that's the case, then they'll be able to get these players a lot of experience in game quickly before the games really matter.
Yeah, that definitely is going to matter a lot with Jacob Eason. I mean, the running back transition is going to be interesting. Will Savon Ahmed be the every down back? How involved are Sean McGrew and Kamari Pleasant, who we saw back on the field for the first time in a while?
I used to believe that there was no such thing as an every down back, but I do not think that Savon Ahmed is an every down back.
I mean, you know, the one game he played against Cal, number one, it was a great defense, and number two, he was injured. So I don't know that that was a fair test of Savon Ahmed's abilities. But he also, that just may not be the best use of him, is just as a traditional running back on every down. You may want to do other things with him.
He was really bad in the Rose Bowl, right?
Was he?
Yeah, I think his stats were.
I barely remember him even getting carries in the Rose Bowl, if we're being honest.
Oh, so they do have Cal in week two. We talked about that before.
Yes.
Oh, God. At least that's at home.
Yes. And who knows how many interceptions Cal may throw in that game.
It's going to be a real test for Jacob Eason right away, though.
Yeah, Savon Ahmed had 5 carries for 4 yards.
That was a bad game.
But I don't know. I mean, I think how many of those were...
Also, Eastern's playing in the FBS championship coming up.
That is accurate. Yes.
It's over. I take it all back.
0-12 season coming. Bold prediction. Mark it.
They're definitely losing to Hawaii.
Look, you'd have almost lost to Hawaii in Coach Pete's first game. Granted, that was in Honolulu as opposed to here.
No, I'm still feeling confident for next season. I don't look at next season as a rebuilding year. It's a bit of a...
I don't know if it's a rebuilding year, but I don't think it's a make the New Year's six year.
Probably not. We didn't think that the year that they went to the College Football Playoff was a make a New Year's six year either.
No, I mean...
Things can't come into place faster than you realize.
I did feel a lot better watching Justin Herbert in Oregon.
I'm telling you, he sucks. I mean, I didn't think Haskins, like, he made
I don't know
some
who's playing
okay
play
throws.
I don't know who's going to play quarterback for Stanford next year, but that's the team that concerns me because they're always good.
Sure. Haskins made some okay throws, but again, it was like, I don't feel like I've seen like a top-tier passer that the Huskies have played and been like, that guy's really good.
Not since Marcus Mariota?
Mariota and Andrew Luck. Seeing both,
we definitely didn't think about it, Jared Goff.
No, I thought Goff sucked, and he did suck for a year.
I don't think he sucked at Cal, but I didn't think he was elite.
It's just KJ Costello, Mariota. What was the quarterback for Eastern?
Vernon Adams.
Yeah,
we're still waiting for him to blow
up. Four favorite college football or opposing college football quarterbacks that have played the Huskies. Vernon Adams. We knew Cooper Kupp was going to be a star before anybody did.
I feel like we didn't pay as much attention to Cooper Kupp in that game as we did Vernon Adams.
Man, God, Vernon Adams.
Kupp was really good. Like the game he had against Wazoo where they beat them the next year. That was the Cooper Kupp game. God,
he's amazing. He's derailed. If the Seahawks somehow play, I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, the Rams next week. They're going to win that game because Cooper Kupp is not playing.
Okay.
Because the Seahawks injured Cooper Kupp. The Rams are not going to win the Super Bowl because of the Seahawks injuring Cooper Kupp.
Vernon Adams signed a 2-year contract extension with the Montreal Alouettes in October, despite the fact that...
He's a freaking superstar.
Oh, no, he did play for them this year. Right? They don't have the stats on his Wikipedia page, though.
Those are the four college football quarterbacks who I've ever been impressed with. Mariota, Andrew Luck, Vernon Adams, and KJ Costello.
I feel like that's enough to go out on.
Well, Happy New Year to everybody.
Absolutely. A toast to a new year. Happy New Year to the listener.
To a Happy New Year. And again, for being with us through all of 2018. We look forward to an excellent 2019. And starting mid-February, Ramen Bracket.
And go Hawks.